Welcome to Local Talk Wednesday on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in our seven-county listening area in central Iowa. Thank you for listening in. I am your host for today, Susan Franzen. Our hour together today will start by meeting an important but little-known community of refugees in Iowa, the Burmese. Then my viral co-hosts, Pat Schlarbaum and Ursula Rudenberg, will bring us an interview with Chris Peterson, a traditional Iowa farmer whose life experience has led him to become a farm activist. On a related theme, Pat also brings us an interview with Molly Hansen from Iowa Rivers Revival. And finally, our new segment called Candidates with Cal, covering primary candidates in our area, interviewed by Cal Halliburton. And today's candidate for the Democratic nomination in the 4th Congressional District is J.D. Scholten. The other two candidates have been scheduled for Monday and Friday. A busy morning indeed, and our first guest, Jill Nicewander, is with us by phone from the Des Moines offices of Embark, an organization that supports Burmese refugees. Hello, Jill.
Hi, good morning.
The current crisis that brought your group to my attention was an article in the Des Moines Register about letters that the refugees have been getting from the Immigration Service. Could you give us a little background on that?
Sure. At the beginning of February, our community members from Burma began receiving letters from USCIS indicating that they were required or being asked to attend an interview with USCIS and that they were being asked to return to their original city of resettlement to conduct this interview. Unfortunately, when the letters went out from different field offices across the country, they were not sent in any sort of consistent manner. Some of them weren't even sent on official USCIS letterhead. And so there were concerns right away with the community that maybe this was a scam, that maybe they were fishing for information. They weren't really sure what was going on. So thankfully, the community members brought some of the letters to Embark, and we were able to start working with the community to address this issue, and unfortunately, we don't know a lot more than we did a few weeks ago. USCIS has not been cooperative in providing additional information about what these interviews are about or why they're targeting specific groups or, you know, what the consequences are of attending or not attending those interviews. We do know that there's no interpretation being provided for those interviews, and the letter also indicated that if clients felt like they needed to bring an attorney that they were welcome to, but that attorney would be at their own cost and would not be able to act as their interpreter as well. So we've never really had anything like this happen in the community, and it was very confusing because a lot of the people who received the letters, some of them were United States citizens already. Some of them have had their permanent residency through having a green card for many years. So to be compelled to appear at an interview like this with an immigration service and not know the consequences of that interview is very concerning. It's very frightening for the community and for a group of people who have been persecuted by their own government for the majority of their life. It's an all too familiar trauma that they didn't need to re-experience. So it's been a really hard couple of weeks for sure.
For those people who are not familiar with the situation in Burma, or is now officially named Myanmar, why do you call yourself Burmese rather than Myanmar?
It kind of depends on what ethnic group you are from. So the current government in Burma is a militant government, and their preference is for the name of the country to be Myanmar. The United Nations did not recognize Burma as Myanmar until the early 90s, when the militant government made some concessions in human rights and some of the violations of the community were addressed. Worldwide, it is now recognized as Myanmar, but a lot of the ethnic groups prefer to call it Burma.
Could you give us just a short introduction to that and why these people are refugees and when they came?
Sure. So Burma / Myanmar, like you mentioned, has been in civil war for almost 70 years. They actually have the longest running civil war in history. And during that time, there has been a lot of persecution of different groups. There's a lot of diversity in Burma. There's language diversity, there's cultural diversity, there's religious diversity, and that has given rise to a lot of communities being isolated, being persecuted, and being pushed out by whoever happens to be in power at the time. And so that is what has led to a large group of refugees coming from that country. For Iowa's resettlement situation, communities from Burma started coming in about 2007, 2008, and the Burma refugees have been the largest group to be resettled from probably 2016 back 5 years. So we estimate that there are about 10,000 refugees from Burma in Iowa, and a lot of them are in here in Polk County in central Iowa, but they do have larger pockets throughout the state, and that's usually driven by where there are job opportunities for the community.
Are new people arriving all the time, or is the immigration of refugees stopped?
It hasn't completely stopped. It is very, very slow right now. Traditionally, in the last 5 years or so, Iowa has resettled approximately 1,000 people a year, and I think for this current government fiscal year, which started in September of 2007, we're at about 150. So we're at about 10% of where we usually are. And that's really disappointing. A lot of family connections had already been set up. And people were expecting family members who are now not coming because of some of the issues that the administration have raised and some of the policies that they're trying to enact. So that's definitely been detrimental to resettlement nationally. Trump set the lowest ceiling for refugee resettlement in the history of the United States resettling refugees at 45,000 this year. But at the current rate of resettlement nationwide, there's no way we'll even get to that in this year.
Does Iowa have an especially large proportion of the Burmese refugees?
No, we do not have a disproportionately large portion. I get this question a lot, and my answer is always that folks who come to Iowa come here for the same reasons that everyone else does. We have a great public school system. We have a low cost of living. Until last year, we had a federally competitive minimum wage. We have job opportunities. You know, the job market is really good here. So they come for the same reasons we do. A lot of people don't know that while refugees are settled in a particular location when they arrive, they're free to move around the country just like you and I are. They're not limited by a visa or, they're not limited to where they can go. So they might get resettled in one city and have family members that come here. And so they come and have that family support. And once a community kind of gets established, then it attracts other community members. So that's how some of the growth happens.
What kind of jobs can they take?
Well, a lot of them are employed by meatpacking plants, by large manufacturers, which is a fine starting place, and the meatpacking plants have been supportive of refugee communities over the past several years, so that has been a plus, but, you know, they're always looking to upskill and go into different industries and work that's not quite so physically demanding and where they might have a little bit more of a career path. So it kind of depends on what their language skills are. It depends on what maybe their education was in their home country and how they have the ability to move within their community and what kind of supports they have.
Are all of these immigrants, because of the way they arrived, legal immigrants?
Well, all of them are refugees, and being a refugee is a legal status, so they're actually not immigrants. They come to this country as refugees, and then refugees have a very specific path to legal permanent residency and citizenship. So, yes, they do come to our country legally.
The current issue that we read about in the papers is the persecution of the Rohingya. And are any of these Rohingya?
The folks that are receiving the letters are not Rohingyas, but we do have a very small Rohingya population here in Iowa, probably 100 to less than 200 people statewide. So they're very small pockets of that ethnic group that are present here in the state.
How did MBARC get started?
MBARC stands for the Ethnic Minorities of Burma Advocacy and Resource Center.
Tell a little about what its mission is and how it operates. I noticed you're quite a large organization.
Yeah, we are fairly new, and we have grown exponentially over the past almost 4 years that we have been in existence. But Embark was founded by and for refugees from Burma. So we are an ethnic community-based organization here in Iowa. Our board is led by refugees. So we have 5 refugee members of our board and 2 native English speakers. And we look to them for leadership in what the community needs, and then all work together to solve problems. And our mission is to expand the world of opportunities for refugees here in Iowa. And we do that by providing education, advocacy, and community development opportunities.
I noticed one of your members is in health services. Is there any special reason for that?
You know, when one of the things that I love about this community is that when they have the opportunity to rise up and to move forward and to improve themselves, they're always doing it with their community in mind. So a lot of times when we have young people that go to college or people who move up from their entry-level jobs, they do that in human services, in healthcare services. Anything that they can do to help support their community and give back is where they want to keep their focus.
You also operate with volunteers. Do you want to say anything about your volunteers?
Absolutely. Our volunteers are critical to the work that we do. One of the things that Embark does on a regular basis for the community is we host walk-in hours. And so we host a clinic twice a week, and folks from the community are able to come in and have their non-emergency reoccurring requests met. So maybe they need help reading their mail, maybe they need help setting up an appointment, maybe they need help filling out some paperwork. So we try and be there for them in that way, and we support that program completely with volunteers. We have native English speakers who volunteer there, we have community members who provide language services that volunteer there. So our walk-in clinic is just a really great example of how Embark leverages our volunteer workforce. Really, they provide so much for us, and we're so grateful to those who participate in our community and get to know our community members. Our volunteers are really great about really going deep with our clients and creating relationships and being a resource for them, and we use volunteers as mentors. We have a really great mentor program here in Des Moines and also in Waterloo. And we also do a family sponsorship program where we try and match refugee families with native English-speaking families here in Iowa and create a support system for them. Because when you think about when you go through your life, who do you depend on and who do you look to when you need help and support? And we try and create those relationships for our refugee families as well. So we use volunteers in every program that we have. And we just really go so far with concerned and caring people who are willing to share their skills with us in the community.
If any of our listeners want to learn more about Embark or becoming volunteers themselves, how can they learn more?
Yeah, our website is a great resource for anyone that wants to learn more about the Burma community here in Iowa or about volunteer opportunities with Embark. And our website is www.embarcrciowa.org. And there's a Get Involved page on the website, and they can click on there, and there is a really nice volunteer application form there, and they can indicate where their interest and skill set lies, and then we can match them to opportunities within the organization.
Would you like to give us a sample of some of the things that people could do?
Sure. We have people that help with our community-based ESL programs. So some of those are certified ESL teachers. Some of them just help coordinate and work on transportation. We also have a parent navigator program that we offer volunteer opportunities through. We have mentors. We're always needing mentors to match up with our community members who have specific needs. Maybe they want to learn more English. Maybe they need to learn how to drive. It's a whole variety of skills and goals that the community is working on, so we always have opportunities there. And I had briefly mentioned earlier about our family sponsorship program, where we match families with native English-speaking families here in the community to become kind of a support system. And any family or group, we've had church groups and best friends be sponsorships to families, so that can look kind of any way that folks would like it to. So there's a lot of latitude in that and how we can connect people through that opportunity. But we also take donations. So, you know, if your organization does clothing drives or in the winter, we often do coat drives, especially for the youth and the small children in the community. So those are some of the ways that people might be able to get in touch with this community and help their neighbors that maybe they didn't know about before.
Thanks, Jill. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Thank you.
trên anh khá cả sông lệ ông chỉ đau em sống lâu lại bà nè anh ấy lấy mẹ bà xê sự kiện lẻ mẹ bà xê a chơi nái thi xa nà chân dê yên hà bê chơi bê hoa lê anh à kèm nhà mau mãi nê lê bê đi bà hoa đi lê trôi thiệu phê nê yêu linh chất sâu đi à mà bà huyên mà lê bê xa khá đà dân mạc cho lê yêu lâu nay mi khá khê rai chân đê gà mi đà tì à nê yêu linh chất sâu đi à mà bà huyên mà lê bê xa khá đà dân mạc cho lê yêu lâu nay mi khá khê rai yên đê gà tì xa tì à nê bê xa là
In case you just tuned in, this is KHOI Community Radio, and you've just heard from Jill Nyswander from Embark, an organization that supports Burmese refugees. Pat Schlarbaum and Ursula Rudenberg are bringing us Chris Peterson, a farmer who became an activist late in his life based on his own experiences. Let's hear what they have to say.
Today in KHOI Studios, farmer Chris Peterson from Clear Lake, Iowa, Ursula Rudenberg, station manager, Pat Schlarbaum, and welcome.
Well, thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
You're doing a lot of organizing and yep. You're talking to a lot of people.
I've been in the advocacy fight for family farms and for rural and for the animals and for the environment for 25 years, and as I got deeper into that, I let some of the farming go. I still farm part-time, but been a farmer all my life, and in witnessing what my dad done, what my grandfather done, who immigrated from Denmark, and the stories told going back in generations, you treat the land right, you treat the animals right, you will be rewarded. And that's what I've practiced all my life.
Your grandfather came to Iowa to farm?
Yep.
From Denmark?
Yep. 1913.
And were they the farm corn and soybeans as well? Or were when they started, was it a different type of farming?
Yeah, soybeans weren't on the radar yet. But, the corn, oats, hay rotation.
Mm-hmm. Soybeans in the 1950s?
And while you're describing your background, why don't you say where the farm is?
Yep.
This is land that's been passed down from your grandfather? Or
no. Long story. You know, families mm-hmm. always have long stories.
Yeah.
And my grandfather farmed about 3 miles east of Thornton, Iowa. I'm about 6 miles north central Iowa, right south of Mason City, Clear Lake. He retired in the mid to late 50s, moved to Thornton. I've been on my place since 1978. We moved there in a blizzard with livestock and everything, December 1st. And row cropped till a few years ago. I still got hogs, not a lot of them. At one time, we were doing 400 acres with 6 row equipment, baling 12 to 15,000 small square bales of hay every summer. And 1 year we got up to 3,000 head of hogs farrow to finish. We were busy. We didn't have a life. But seems like we were happy. We were doing what we wanted to do.
Well, there was a farm crisis in the 1980s. How were you able to persevere, survive, make it through that tough era?
Yeah, it was real tough. That's when I first got started. And when we got married in 74, until 1992, I worked a full-time night shift job in town, too, and invested in the farming, grew it up more and more. And in 92, it would work cash flow-wise and everything else, so I quit working in town. And
the preference is always to work on the farm.
Oh, absolutely. That's all I ever wanted to do in my life was just farm, mm-hmm. It's in the blood, so to speak.
having described that your passion was being a farmer, that it was a consuming occupation that you strove to do full time, what makes this suddenly a situation that provokes you to become an activist? What are the elements that actually go wrong in a situation like that that suddenly change your direction in terms of thinking about all this? Does that question make sense?
Pretty easy to answer. The 80s came and went. The farm crisis, a lot of farmers got ran out, quit, bankruptcy. Some of them committed suicide. Very challenging times. And
the essence of that was that farmers were losing their land.
Yeah. And when you're a farmer, let's put it this way, when you're in town, you have a small business or whatever, and you file bankruptcy, it's usually separated out, LLCs and everything else from your home. When you farm, everything's in one pot. At least it was back then. So the bank is foreclosing on you, or you're forced into a bankruptcy. Every single thing in your life is on the line. It's a whole different game.
It doesn't make sense to in a way, help to explain that phenomenon of the farm crisis, in that farming is an activity that requires heavy investment, financial. Mm-hmm. And that in the 80s, what happened was that investment process broke down.
Yep.
And farmers were not able to pay their debts.
18% interest on top of the debt.
Mm-hmm. And because of that, began to lose land, and banks began to go under as well. Local banks began to go under as well.
Mm-hmm. Banks will loan you all the money you want as long as you got assets to back it up. When you lose those, or losing those assets, the banks become your enemy, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way it works.
So that's to say that there's a very heavy financial risk involved with farming.
Oh, absolutely.
That goes with investment. That it's not just, you know, the going out and putting your hand in the dirt. You're investing in something.
And I was always very business conscious and tight with the money.
Mm-hmm. Because farming's a business.
Yeah, and some of them, you know, new machinery all the time, new pickups, this and that. Hey, I'd keep it till you couldn't afford to fix it anymore, and then think, well, maybe it's time I got something else.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way I farmed. It's called farming on the cheap.
So what was it that made you come to the conclusion that something was not right? What was that?
Just the consolidation. And my quick response to that is, bigger is not better.
So talk about the consolidation.
Yeah.
What does that mean in Iowa?
Well, what does that mean? Well, if you live in Iowa, you probably read about it occasionally, how rural is declining, the small towns are drying up, no young farm families anymore.
And why is that?
Well, unless you got some old money, like dad's money or grandpa's money, you just can't walk into a bank or a financial institution and say, hey, I want a farm. I need a few million to buy the land. I need, you know, a million at least to buy machinery, right down the list. Well, it ain't going to happen. That's a consolidation thing. And the margins are so tight.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I always worked off farm. I didn't get much sleep, but, you know, we managed to hold it together.
So what does consolidation look like in Iowa? Describe that.
Well, you got the hogs, the livestock, you know. I'm an independent pig farmer. I don't do confinements. I'm in the niche markets now. 94% of us are gone, ran out, quit, or whatever.
So if in Iowa is flat in many places. So in a lot of places in Iowa, if you stand in one spot and look in all four directions, you're likely to see a confinement lot.
Yeah, I got a friend who farms over by Spencer, Iowa. And he can stand on top of his grain bin and count 100 of them.
Wow.
Because he can see, you know, a number of miles away.
Wow.
So.
Oh, my God. Okay, so, you know, this is really intense to talk about it because you're really describing the destruction of your culture and your profession. Yeah. So I want to acknowledge that because it's very painful to hear, but I can't imagine what it's like to describe it when it's your life, you know?
Yeah.
So I guess talk to us about what you're doing, about the activism you do, like where you see the future.
Well, I see our side making big strides in educating the public, all the ways from the local to the state level to the national level. People are waking up, and they want to put a face on their food. That's the first thing. They want safe food. They want animal welfare incorporated with that meat they are eating. It's a good thing. And
how do you educate people? How do you reach people?
I live on Facebook, for one thing. I got friends not only in this country but all over the world I communicate with. I got closed groups. I think I'm involved in 50 closed groups where it's internalized, nothing gets out, where we talk a lot about this stuff and people doing different things, sharing ideas, putting different ways of doing things in other people's heads. You know, it's democracy.
And you mentioned Clear Lake and the dissension that it put through that community. Was that 20 years ago?
That was south of town. And then a year later, we had Sparble Eggs try and come in and put, if I remember, I was close to 3 million chick laying hens 2 miles west of our place, 6 miles south of Clear Lake. And we rallied the whole community, Mesa City, Clear Lake.
Was that when your activism really got started?
At the local level, yeah. And we'd done enough telling the truth and hell-raising that Sparble Eggs packed up and left. And then 2 years ago, Prestige Pack tried to build an 18,000 hog kill a day plant within the city limits of Mason City. Again, we organized and got the city council's head screwed on right, and they vetoed it. So we've won 3 big ones in our community
God
as far as keeping them away. Mason City, historical town with Frank Lloyd Wright and Meredith Wilson and stuff like that. Clear Lake, the surf ballroom, Buddy Holly, recreational area. 80% of the money that comes into Clear Lake every year comes from tourism. It's huge. It's not a farm community.
Because they have a lake.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, 3,700 or whatever it is acre natural lake.
Mm-hmm.
And we fight for our area.
And there is a watershed group
that there is.
Clear really
Project.
Implemented and became nationally recognized as part of the template on how to treat a beautiful natural lake in Iowa is one thing is you have to control the confinement feeding operations
you gotta control
in that
the runoff.
Watershed.
And, you know, the Clear Lake watershed, there's a lot of buffer stuff going on, buffer strip. Yeah, there's still corn and soybeans, but it's more heavily looked at, you know, the runoff issues and everything else. So,
do you feel hopeful that these huge lots, confinement lots, with these huge corporations behind them can actually be undone again? Do you feel that that's possible?
To a certain point. The federal government, what that needs to do is create enticements to make them do the right things. Even farmers, you know, as far as minimum till, no-till, all that. The bad actors comes a point in time, there needs to be mandatory compliance. You're doing something wrong, you either get a hell of a fine or you get punished or you get put out of business. And the other part of that is growing the number of people who are eating our type of product, you know, whether it's pork, beef, eggs, or vegetables or whatever. I'm not saying, you know, organic's okay, but my 2 key words are sustainable and local. that's where I'm at.
You're talking about how, you know, part of it has to do with what people want. In your communication with people, do people tell you that it upsets them to see the confinement lots on the landscape?
Oh, yeah. You know, take a drive out in the countryside. It used to be you drove across the state of Iowa every mile or two, you'd see pigs, cattle, something, and you don't see that anymore.
Yeah, I think that's something people don't realize, that in Iowa, you do not see any animals.
No.
Anywhere.
And you drive by my place, well, you see my pigs. And but that goes back to our 94% of us are gone, you know. And when my dad farmed in the 60s, we were feeding hogs, I don't know, a few hundred, had 600 laying hens. He had sheep, diversified cropping system, you know. It's changed,
mm-hmm.
and not for the better.
What do you, if you could visualize the future of Iowa, what would you like to see?
Well, I first thing I want to see is decent markets backed up by antitrust and transparency in the marketplace. So a farmer has a chance to make a buck selling into that market and getting a return on it. The other thing is we got to figure out something here. You know, they make fun of a lot of us guys. Oh, yeah, you want to go back to the horse and plow and all that stuff. No, we don't. Use all the modern machinery you want, whatever. Even the confinement building. If it's behind a farmer's house and he owns that livestock, I'm talking 1,000 head here, whatever, and it's on his place, and he owns those pigs, he's going to take care of those pigs a lot better than a contract grower or a corporation owning the pigs. He's going to take the manure and apply it where it's needed. In other words, he wants to get as much money as he can out of that manure. And he'll smell it first, so he'll really work on controlling the smell. Family farms, the size is limited by the family. You know, you have some family corporations, but there's an ownership component there. And when things are in the hands of the farmers and the farmers have ownership responsibility, it's going to be a heck of a lot better. That's where we got to get back to in this state, I believe. I don't care if it's a 20-acre farm or a 5,000-acre farm.
Mm-hmm.
And I will say some of the guys are doing those things, but we need a lot more doing it the right way.
Mm-hmm.
It's just this whole industry, whether it's Packers owning pigs or the contract growers or a third party who is the in-betweener and all of this, it's kind of a free-for-all. It's all about big money,
mm-hmm.
every bit of it.
Now, Iowa's former Governor Branstad is now the ambassador to China. Is that about hogs?
Oh, a lot of it is. It's a lot about Iowa. More hogs, more soybeans, more corn.
It's about selling more hogs to China?
Yeah.
Or what's the possibility of China starting to raise more of their hogs where our export numbers will decline or diminish?
Mm-hmm. Why would China want to do it when they own 25% of the pigs in Iowa and create the mess over here? I guess my ending comment is if the voters and the consuming public of this country knew what was going on in agriculture, specifically the confinement industry, whether it's chickens, hogs, or cattle, very quickly they would conclude it's unacceptable.
Thank you, Chris Peterson, Clear Lake, Iowa.
This is KHOI Community Radio, Story City, Ames, and the surrounding area. You've just been hearing from Chris Peterson, a farm activist and traditional farmer with in conversation with Pat Schlarbaum and Ursula Rudenberg. Pat Schlarbaum is now bringing us an interview with another activist, Molly Hansen from Iowa Rivers Revival.
Hello, Molly Hansen, Iowa Rivers Revival.
Hello.
What was your recent honor that you received in 2017?
Yeah, we were highlighted by the Des Moines Register at the beginning of the year to talk about, they call it a people to watch, but things that are going to be going on. And so that was an opportunity for us to continue to see the press cover issues around water and water quality and continue to provide a platform and support for the work that we're doing.
Fill us in on the water bill that was signed by the governor recently. Where are we at with water in Iowa?
Sure. The good news is that the conversation is continuing, and the bill that was passed and signed, it is a water quality bill. As most people have said, it's really just a first start. I'd like to see a lot more done. The House version of that bill, the Senate version is the one that passed. The House version of that bill was a little more comprehensive, provided a little more flexibility, and also focused on things that our group really supports, which is the watershed approach, measurable goals, and measurements, as well as monitoring, so that we know kind of where we are along the process, how far we need to go, and that accountability piece of, as if we're going to put money into these projects, we want to make sure that they're done in a very pragmatic and kind of a way that is holistic rather than kind of putting a Band-Aid on something.
Oh, exactly. So accountability, how can we strengthen? What are some of the benefits of accountability from your line of thinking?
Absolutely. That's something that we always want to talk about. Numbers and data are really helpful for us in order to set benchmarks and goals. If we really do have a goal of nutrient reduction in this state, and that's the, generally speaking, the amount of nitrogen and phosphorus leaving the state of Iowa, if we have reduction goals, we need to know where we're at, and we need to know how much we can get done over a given period of time. And that's going to help us know which practices are working best, where we can utilize those to be most effective, and figure out how to utilize the watershed approach and bring in, you know, all the players who would be involved in actually making an impact on those numbers.
And what was the value, or what was the current legislation? How many millions is devoted to that? And where is the money coming from?
It's kind of a combination of things. Right now, there is a water tax, and that is going to be a piece of it. There is some money that will be coming out of the general fund, which is something that we wanted to avoid. And there, a lot of that money is going to be available for different groups, hopefully including things like watershed management authorities and groups that we really do like the work that they're doing in order to encourage really that collaborative effort. Now, what we really would ultimately like to see is, and recently on Monday we had the Fund the Trust Day up at the Capitol, what we'd like to see is that sales tax increase of 0.375 that would generate $180 million of new revenue, so we don't have to pull any money out of the general fund. And about 60% of that, it's stipulated, would go towards water quality. And actually the passage and funding of that trust, passage of the sales tax, funding of the trust, would actually eliminate this water quality bill, because it would supersede that with an abundance of funding for even more projects.
And how many millions is in this current bill?
The current bill is a little bit less. I think it's like $50 million or something, and I'm not totally positive on that amount, but it's been quoted as kind of a drop in the bucket. You know, it's certainly not comprehensive, it's certainly not long-term, and it does have a sunset date, so it's only guaranteed funding for a certain period of time, and then that funding would no longer be available. So when they say that this is a start, I think that's the momentum that needs to carry this conversation forward. Appreciate that the legislature is working on this, but we need them to do a lot more in order to see, you know, the impacts and the results that we want to, as in improvement for our state.
So how is the Iowa Rivers Revival kind of putting the message out there?
Sure. So our legislative priorities are like I said, the sales tax, good water quality bills with a watershed approach. We support fully funding REAP, which is a program through the DNR that provides a lot of great grants for different groups, including our own organization, as well as, you know, focusing on what river restoration in Iowa can look like and should look like. And so how we communicate with our supporters is we do weekend updates right before you head into the weekend. The forums that are going to be going on, if people do want to participate, bills that we want them to have on their radar, some talking points that will make it a little bit more comfortable to speak with their elected officials, and that's all available through our website and social media.
Iowa Rivers Revival.
Correct. Yep. www.iowarivers.org.
And there's quite a resurgence discovering, if you will, our rivers through our urban areas. Manchester, Charles City come to mind. How does that fit into the big picture of your environmental outreach?
Absolutely. So another one of our big priorities is funding for Lowhead Dam mitigation and water trail expansion. And to those programs you just mentioned in Manchester and Charles City and Elkader were recipients of that kind of a funding. And we're seeing even bigger excitement kind of build in areas like Ames and Cedar Falls and Iowa City and now even downtown Des Moines about what removing those dams can do for communities in terms of recreational opportunities, tourism, economic development, and then and, you know, fun stuff for people to do that makes them want to visit Iowa or stay in Iowa.
Yeah, I'd like to think the fun stuff is that that glass is half full. We're really entering into an exciting time period, but the metaphor of the glass half full, half empty, it's like water quality. I understand there's a group that you've started with Women in Water.
Sure. So Women for Water is something that was kind of born out of last legislative session. There were a lot of really dedicated women that were working on a water quality issue and just weren't seeing the traction that they wanted to in terms of, you know, A, having a voice at the table, but B, you know, being listened to, being taken seriously, and then feeling like they could have an impact on legislation ultimately. And so Women for Water is a group that is completely volunteer run right now and is all about reaching out to women to encourage them to tell their stories around water, you know, everything from your earliest memory around water to, you know, what that looks like today. Do your children still have that same experience that you were able to have? And if not, how do we start addressing those concerns that they might have at the very local level, neighborhoods, communities, schools, and kind of empowering women to share their story and their concerns around water and encouraging them to be able to participate in the process that can start making changes around those concerns.
Is it time to start looking forward to some river cleanups in the spring? Do you have anything planned?
Absolutely. That's one of our favorite things to do is to get out there. And so we have a volunteer group called the Service Squad that's a joint effort between us and the Iowa Environmental Council, and it's the people who want to get out and get their hands dirty. So we adopted a section of Four Mile Creek over near Sleepy Hollow, the border of Des Moines and Pleasant Hill, and we're planning creek cleanups that'll be going on this spring and summer, family friendly as well as corporate events that we can really get a bunch of people down there and pull out a bunch of garbage.
You're doing fantastic work. Thanks so much. Is there anything else that you'd like to share with our KHOI listeners?
Absolutely. Well, I just want to say thank you, you know, for everyone around Iowa that has been talking about water and showing up to forums and really participating in the process. You know, we see that this conversation continues because so many people are passionate about this. And so now is the time to really speak up and get involved and attend things. You know, one of the hardest parts is just showing up. And the more people who are willing to show up and talk about water, you know, the more likely we are to really see some positive changes for our state.
Positive change. Thank you, Molly Hansen, Iowa River Revival. Keep up the good work. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
This is KHOI Community Radio, bringing you Candidates with Cal, interviews with primary candidates conducted by Cal Halliburton.
It's our pleasure today to be talking with J.D. Scholten. J.D. is running in the primary election to be held June 5th for the Democratic Party nomination as a candidate for the 4th Congressional District of Iowa. J.D. is a fifth-generation Iowan. He was born at Mary Greeley Hospital in Ames and at 3 moved with his parents to Sioux City, where he grew up. J.D. was active in athletics, earning multiple varsity letters and all-state honors. He attended Morningside College and graduated from the University of Nebraska. Following college, J.D. pursued a professional baseball career in the United States and Canada and played across Europe. Between seasons, J.D. began a career as a litigation paralegal, specializing in discovery, intellectual property law, and trials. J.D., could you tell our listeners something about yourself that they won't find on your website or with a search engine?
Well, with the Winter Olympics happening, I also curled for 3 years. Great to see Team Schuster win the gold medal.
You've been doing a lot of traveling around the district. As you've talked with people across the district, what are their most frequent concerns?
The number one thing that I hear is healthcare. It's something that affects everybody, whether you're urban or rural. It's prices are getting high, far too high for my comfort. You look at some of these small town communities and the largest building or employer in that area is either the retirement home or a medical facility. And with some of the cuts that are happening, there's a lot of worry about consolidation. I'm hearing healthcare all around, whether it's Sioux City or a small town.
With healthcare being a primary focus, then, would that be one of your priorities?
It's my number one priority.
Do you have an action that you would take with regard to that?
Yeah. Immediately, I think we should be putting in a public option so we can at least stabilize the markets. I would like to get a Medicare buy-in for 55-plus that will allow a lot of the people who want to retire can do so easily and with the long-term goal of Medicare for all.
Are there any other concerns that come to anywhere near the level of health care?
Well, the economy is always a thing. I was living in Seattle, and I was planning on moving back. And I was working in an innovation, and I was thinking about starting a company here. And it just never developed. But what I saw out there and the technology that's coming, I can see what we can do in this district. And one thing for me is that most of the kids I grew up with, and including myself, we moved away. And I want to have an economy that can absorb the college graduate, because right now in this district, the majority of this district doesn't have the economy that can do so. And that's a passion of mine, to what I like to call the new rural economy, where we take our traditional agriculture, we bring in advanced manufacturing, and then the third component is bringing in green technology jobs that will piggyback off the fact that we lead the nation in wind energy. And I view that as the success of helping the smaller towns that are starting to struggle a little bit. And I think that's the direction we need to go to, not only in the 4th District, but throughout most of Iowa and a lot of the Midwest.
Hey, we've got health care and we've got economy.
I'm 6'6", and our campaign's motto is standing tall for all. And it's not only because of my height. It's for an inclusive community. And last night I ended up going to the Dreamers Dinner at St. Thomas Aquinas over here by the college. And that's part of that inclusiveness, that inclusive community is protecting dreamers. And this district needs to have a common sense approach to immigration. You look at Sioux County, if we got rid of all the immigrants, the economy would just collapse. And so we need a common sense immigration reform, which hasn't been done since 1986.
Is that a unique situation in Sioux County?
I wouldn't say it's unique. We're seeing that all over. In Greene County, for the harvest last fall, they had 39 openings to help the co-op. They had to get immigrant labor because there was nobody to fulfill these 39 jobs. And we're seeing that throughout the district.
What actions would you take in order to get things done?
One is co-sponsor a bill. Being a freshman representative, I wouldn't have a lot of pull. I think we owe it to the economy, the Iowa economy, and our neighbors who have been here for 20 years to have a common sense approach so folks don't live in that fear. Pushing the agenda, being outspoken and truly standing for your principles. I think those are things you can go there, and not just take back seat and do what you're told. Fighting for your district, whether it's proposing a bill, whether it's just getting the exposure out there to make sure that these issues are being talked about, that's a main focus.
Let's explore that a little bit more. Do you see where you've seen some communities with a number of immigrants participating economically in the community, and then there are others where there are not so many? Are there conflicts over that in the community?
I haven't seen a lot of it. It's a tough topic. I talked to a DACA recipient yesterday who said she had a tough time talking to her friends about this situation when she was transitioning or applying for DACA, because you don't know what your status of your friends are. And it's not like, hi, I'm JD, I'm a legal citizen. And so a lot of folks, it's an uneasiness there. And some people assume and you don't know. It's a tough thing of opening up about.
Saying it's hard for immigrants to open up about this.
Absolutely. And a lot of it is families are split. So maybe one of the children's a DACA recipient. Maybe one of the parents came a U.S. citizen, but the other one didn't. And then one of the siblings might have been born here. So it's not like everyone's all legal or all undocumented. It's really a difficult hodgepodge. It's not like one family's all this and one family's not. Not only is it more complex, our immigration system, the court system, is really backed up. And for the most part of this district, the court is in Omaha, and they just went down a judge. So now they're down to three. Some of these families have been waiting 15 years to get a sibling or somebody in their family to become a citizen. The process has taken that long. And some of these folks, if they were waiting for the judge that just left, that went back to Chicago, they got put back in the waiting list. And so they have to wait 2 years to have a hearing to decide when the hearing to decide if they're going to become a citizen or not. That's the part that's really not being spoken about.
Were there any other issues that you encountered?
Well, water quality is a major one here in Iowa and in this district. And it's one that there's no solution that's going to be done tomorrow. The state passed a water quality bill. It didn't go very far to address the needs. But one thing that we can do is match things from the federal level, whether it's within the farm bill or not. I have a few ideas on what I want to implement. They're more ideas at this point rather than like an actual bill. But one of the ideas is similar to crop insurance, where it's a private-public relationship where we can feed into that helps farmers. And it's partial infrastructure also, where we can help farmers who want to transition into having those like buffer strips and having the terraces that protect their topsoil from erosion. That's an area that I really want to explore a lot more. Once we start talking about soil health and promoting soil health, I think that doesn't solely solve the issue of water quality, but it helps in the lean towards the right direction.
One of the topics we might spend a little time on that's a real buzzword right now is gun control.
Absolutely.
Do you have a position with regard to that?
I do. Universal background checks right now is polling at 97%. It's so frustrating for me to see numbers like that and for Washington, D.C. to not do anything. I'll get back to gun safety in just 1 second, but there's three things I feel that D.C. is just neglecting right now, and it's universal background checks or gun safety. It's infrastructure. Both sides are talking about it, but nothing's being done. And it's DACA when you have all the Democrats and half the Republicans for, and nothing's being done. And that's the frustration that a lot of people have with politics right now. Are these things the majority of America wants them, but they're not being done? But getting back to your question, I think universal background checks, stopping the loopholes in gun shows, and one of the biggest things that's not being talked about, I feel, is studies of gun violence. The CDC cannot review gun violence, and that makes absolutely no sense. And so I would be for funding either the CDC or whatever agency to study it so we can find solutions. Regarding the assault ban. Well, when it was first proposed in, what was it, passed in 94, Reagan was supportive of it. And a lot of Republicans were supportive of it. And then it ran out in 2004. And now, the minute you mention it, all of a sudden it's a big tiffy. And so I think that debate is going to go throughout 2018 into 2020. I think the presidential debate is going to be talked about that. But I think some of these other issues, they should be easy things that we should be able to pass. And
well, with regard to the assault weapon ban, do you have a position on that?
Yeah, I'm for the ban. And when I was in high school, we took hunter safety. And we have a very strong hunting society here in Iowa. I think that is different than the assault ban and that mentality. But it all gets kind of blended together. I think when it comes to gun violence, there's three actual parts to this. I think there's there's the suicide part, there's the murder part, and then there's the mass shooting part. And I don't think there's simple solutions, but I think the direction we're going and to the amazement of what these high school students down in Florida have accomplished is amazing. I mean, we're, what, 10, 11 days out from the horrific incident. And all of a sudden the NRA is all the partnerships with whether the airlines and things that are dropping out. I mean, these kids were pretty powerful stuff. And it's amazing to see action on something like this, finally.
As you think about what we've been talking about today, is there anything else you'd like to add before we go?
The only thing I would like to add is that you can follow us at scholtenforiowa.com. That's S-C-H-O-L-T-E-N, the number four, I-O-W-A.com. We have a very active social media presence, both on Facebook and Twitter, that you can easily reach out to us there. And we also just opened up an office a few blocks away from here at Kellogg and Lincoln Way here in Ames.
Well, it's been a pleasure talking with you today, J.D. You know, we're getting away without asking you what the J and the D stands for, but maybe we'll do that another time.
I'll say that for another day.
Okay. Thank you very much again. We've been talking with J.D. Scholten, who is running in the primary election to be held June 5th for the Democratic Party nomination as a candidate for the 4th Congressional District of Iowa.
You have been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I have been your host, Susan Franzen, joined by the voices of Pat Schlarbaum and Ursula Rudenberg. Thank you for listening. Other voices you heard were Chris Peterson, Molly Hansen, Jill Nyswander, Cal Halliburton, and J.D. Scholten. Local Talk airs at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. here on KHOI at 89.1 FM. Remember that you can also hear it online at khoifm.org and find links to the guests and information you heard during the program. KHOI is streaming live online at khoifm.org. Today's show was engineered by Jackie Norman. Our theme song, as always, is Backtrackin' by Tom Richards and Al Harris from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Other music you heard was Nini Ki Zwan. Local Talk is a radio production workshop as well as a show. If you would like to try your hand at reporting, we'll train you. Come in and join the Local Talk team. Let us know what you think. You can call us at 515-292-2878, email us at khoiradio@gmail.com, or go to the contact page of our website, khoifm.org. Remember, you, the listener, are what makes KHOI meaningful and possible. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio.